erase it off of the tape. You know, if you ask a question that sounds, I can just leave it on tape. But if I say anything, I can. Okay, tonight we are on Ayin Ches, part 3. In Mirtz Hashem, we will finish Ayin Ches tonight. And the title of this is Class Is Yet Still in Session. And we are completing this kapitel, which was written by Asaph. And Asaph is reviewing history from the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, from the time of going out of Egypt, until the time that David became Melech. And his review of history is not necessarily going in a chronological order, but going in an order to try and make various points. Asaph wants to reinforce amongst the people David's selection, that Hashem wants him to be king. If you recall, David had a lot of opposition during his lifetime. We look back at him as David HaMelech. How could anybody be opposed to David HaMelech? But at the time, many people were, and he suffered a lot through his life from all kinds of oppression, from mild to very cruel. And Asaph is trying to reinforce David's selection as Melech by giving us a tour of history and showing us how we failed at various times and what it is that we need to do about that. Last week we talked about what happened in the Midbar and the 10 times that we tested Hashem. And tonight we're going to take it from that point after the Midbar and as we go into Eretz Yisrael up until the time of David HaMelech. Just a few key points from the introductory part of the kapitel is that Asaph believes that the study of history is very important. That those who don't study history are condemned to repeat it is an idea we've all heard. But with Asaph, what it means is if you don't study history and see what people did right and the reward they got for it, and what people did wrong and the punishment they got for it, you yourself will fall into the same traps of wrong things that people did in the past. He does not consider, nor do we consider history, you know, just to be a study of biographies or facts or dates or a series of events. It is always, I think I said this a few weeks ago, and I don't know if I've lived up to it or not, but I've always said it amazes me how kids in school find history boring. I was one of them in school, but history is often boring in school. History, I don't see how history can be boring. History is an interwoven tapestry of events and ideas guiding one against the other. But if history becomes just a series of dates and times and places, then it is boring. So Asaph is not concerned about dates and times and places. He's following the pattern we see in the Chumash itself, that history is told when there's something to teach us. When there's nothing to teach us, we don't say anything. You'll notice in the Midbar, in the Chumash, we have the first year that they were in the Midbar. We skip 39 years, and then we have the 40th year they were in the Midbar. So weren't they there for those 39 years? Nothing happened interesting? So probably a lot of stuff happened that was interesting. But it has nothing to say to us. So therefore, it's not necessary to be recorded in history. The same thing with the Nevi'im. We have, there were a million Nevi'im, and we could have so many books of Nevuah that it would fill a library. Yet only those Nevuahs that were necessary to have a permanent lesson for the generations were written down. That's the approach that Asaph and all Jewish historians have taken, that those things that are important to teach a lesson for the generations, those are the things that we're going to write down, and those things that don't have a lesson for the generations are not going to be written down. And Asaph also stresses the fact that the Torah teaches eternal truths, but it couches them in very simple-sounding stories. I used the example both last time and the time before of a friend of mine who learned in maybe kindergarten or first grade that Avraham Avinu's tent had a door on every side, on four sides, so that he could always, guests could always have access to his tent. So this person has an image of all these cars driving into Avraham Avinu's tent. Because, you know, when you're 5 years old, there's a garage door on every side. All the cars come in, they could get out, have something to eat, get back in their car and leave. That would be great. Right? To this day, he has a hard time pushing that image out of his mind. Asaph wants, and he pushed this hard last week, people to go back and relearn that which you learned as a child. Because the Torah has depth of many, many levels. And those stories that seemed like we're driving the car into Avraham Avinu's tent have tremendous things to teach us. But not if you don't go back and study them as an adult with an adult's perspective and an adult's mature understanding. And that's what Asaph says he's going to do. He says he's going to explain the riddles to us, because historical events sometimes seem like riddles. And in fact, if you read Nach without the explanations of Chazal, it's very confusing. Just go through Shmuel Aleph and try and figure out what Shaul and Shmuel and David are doing, and who's doing what to whom and whence and why, without the explanations of Chazal, is very much. So Asaph calls these things riddles. The history is a big series of riddles. And finally, he says in his introduction that emunah is not enough, and giving over the Masorah to one's children is not enough. One has to have both. One has to not only tell one's children about emunah and show them that one has emunah, but emunah is not a concrete thing that you can give over. You have to explain to your children the history of the Jewish people, the Masorah of the Jewish people, in order that they should internalize that, and in order that they should build up their own emunah. Now, you can't do that if you don't have emunah yourself. The kids will see that it's not, you know, something you're taking very seriously. But you have to have emunah and Masorah to give over. You cannot give over to the next generation Yiddishkeit with just emunah or just by telling them the Masorah. There's chairs right there. So with that in mind, Asaph begins and has been working his way through this kapitel. We are on Pasuk 38, Lamed Ches, which is on page 4. Now Asaph just finished going over all the things that we did in the Midbar and really drilling home the lesson of the Midbar. And he's going to go further now. 38. So the first thing he says, V'hu rachum, yichaper avon, he's merciful and he wipes out sin, v'lo yashchit, but he doesn't destroy. V'herba l'hashiva po, many times he takes back his wrath, his anger, v'lo ya'ir kol chamaso, and did not arouse all of his anger. So there's two different things that Asaph is referring to. One is Hashem's apo, and the other is chamaso, Hashem's chema. Now, both words really translate into anger, but they mean a little bit different thing. Af refers to the open anger that one displays externally. Now, if I go and I yell at someone how mad I am at them, that's called af. If I'm seething inside, that's called chema. That kind of anger is called chema. So he says, you know what? He holds back his wrath, his external display of anger, and he even holds back his internal feelings of anger. We say this pasuk every night before Mariv. Before the Baruch Hu of Mariv, we say this pasuk every night. And the reason that it was established is because we used to have a morning and an afternoon korban for forgiveness, for atonement, but not a korban at night. Therefore, by the night davening by Mariv, it was instituted to say this pasuk, to say this verse before Mariv, to as a remembrance that even though there's not a specific korban right now, that still we want Hashem to hold back his wrath and his anger, both his af and his chema. Now, we saw last week that the results of what the B'nai Yisrael did in the Midbar, they had a fire, they had a plague, and all those things were just from Hashem's Af. We never even got to the Chema. The Chema is something we don't want to see. So even Hashem holding back his Af resulted in plagues and thousands of Jews dying, and everybody having to stay in the Midbar until that whole generation died out. And we never even got the chema. That was just holding back the af. He says in the next verse, "V'yizkor ki basar hema." He remembers that they're people. Ruach olek. They have a spirit that goes, v'lo yashuv, and doesn't return. Whereas Hashem realizes that, okay, people are not perfect. I didn't create them perfect. They're going to do things wrong. But he says in the next verse, "Kama yamru b'amidbar." But how many times they provoked him in the desert? Gatzivu b'shimo, and vexed him in the wasteland. We talked last thing about all the times that the B'nai Israel tried Hashem in the Midbar. Until finally, after the 10th time, he said, that's it. Everything you did in Mitzrayim is for naught. You're all going to die in the Midbar. We couldn't stop provoking him. In the next verse, he says, Vayashuva Vayanasu Kael, they returned and tried God, Kadosh Yisrael Izvu, and they sought a sign from the Holy One. So every time that we tested, quote unquote, Hashem, we always asked for a sign. Mun is good, but can you give me meat? Meat's even better. Where's the water around here? All right, the service ain't so great. Now, it's interesting. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch says, you know, this generation of the Midbar is a very, very difficult generation to understand, because on the one hand, they were spiritual giants. On the one hand, they toiled in Egypt and had faith that Hashem was going to take them out, and followed Moshe Rabbeinu out into the Midbar and had the Yamsuf. On the one hand, they were people that Chazal tell us the lowliest person by Kriyas Yamsuf had a higher level of Nevuah than Yechezkel Hanavi. On the other hand, if there's not water fast enough, right? So it seems that this generation is a very hard to understand generation. How can they be both scaling the heights and plumbing the depths at the same time? Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch says that it came from the fact that they had inner doubts, and their inner doubts were about the following. They had doubts whether Hashem's power and desire to watch really extended to every facet of life. Sure, Hashem wants to take them out, and Hashem wants to make them his people, but does he really, really, really care to zap me if I don't make a bracha? They had doubts about how much Hashem wanted and was able to be mashkiach, be supervisory over every facet of life. That's what Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch says. And it took them 40 years in the desert to build up that emunah to where they didn't have that problem anymore, to where they realized that everything comes under the providence of Hashem. Now, lest you say that this is a wild thing to say, let's remember 2 weeks ago when we talked about Yagnan and Shevet Ephraim. And they tried to leave Mitzrayim early because they decided that, you know what, we've been here long enough, we're going to break out of this place. The elders told them, listen, you're telling me you have faith in Hashem, that Hashem said he'll get us out of here. So wait, and he'll do it. And they said, no, we have faith that Hashem will get us out, but we don't want to wait anymore. That same kind of thing where they had faith, but it got a little mixed up sometimes in the details, was a problem throughout the entire Midbar. And in fact, it'll be a problem for Shevet Ephraim even longer. Because we've mentioned that Shevet Ephraim was, of course, descended from Yosef HaTzadik. And Yosef had been a king of Egypt. And the descendants of Yosef felt that they were entitled to, if not literally royalty, which they probably were entitled to, at least a little bit better treatment. I mean, come on, we're from Yosef HaTzadik. How many of you guys had ancestors that ruled all of Egypt? And were perfect tzaddikim? Excuse me. So they had a hard time, the B'nai Ephraim, blending in with the crowd, so to speak, just being one of the Shvatim. We'll see that's going to be a problem later. In the next verse, in Pasuk Mem Beis, in 42, it says, Lo Zachor Es Yado. We're going to quickly through a few of these Pasukim, because we're going to get to some very intense things. It says, Did not remember his hand. Yom Asher Padam Minitzar, the day he redeemed them from distress. In other words, they forgot. Before, we talked about the fact that they just didn't have emunah that Hashem would give them water. Or that they had mon, but they wanted meat. But here he's saying they did not remember his hand, meaning they went even further. They forgot what they themselves had seen. They just came out of Mitzrayim. They saw all the makos. They saw all of these things firsthand. And all of a sudden, they're forgetting it. It's sort of like all of my kids, when they were young at a certain age, every night or every day, they would ask, what's for supper? Like we've never fed them in their entire lives. I have no trust whatsoever that we've remembered that today there has to be supper also. Just yesterday there was supper. It was great supper, and we're very happy. But maybe you won't remember that today I need to eat also. So, I mean, la'avdil is, but that idea that they forgot what they themselves had seen. What do you mean Hashem isn't interested? What happened to Mitzrayim? You forgot all that already? Asher samba Mitzrayim, ososav, umovsav, bisedet, so on. Who placed his signs in Egypt and his wonders in the field of Tzoan. Tzoan refers to the capital of Egypt, and his signs and his wonders are referring to the plagues, the makos, which were designed to emphasize Hashem's power. So for example, Yahapok Ladam, the Oreyam, he turned their canals into blood, the rivers into blood, when Ozleyam Bal Yishtavan, their flowing waters they could not drink. Now, we could really stop for the next few pesukim, and we could probably go through the entire Haggadah, and but we're going to try and even though there's so much here that we could talk about, we're going to try and go to Asaph's point. So some of these things I won't go into too much deal for, but you know, just as an example of the Makkah of Dam, if the Jew and the Mitzri drank from the same drinking fountain, right? The thing of water came up, and it went blood into the Mitzri's mouth and water into the Jew's mouth. How do you forget something like that? Yishalach behem arov, he sends wild beasts, ve'ochlehem, all right, it's Vardeya and the frogs, v'tashnichem, which destroyed things, v'yitain l'chasil yivulam, he gave their products to the chasil is a word for locusts, v'giyam l'arbe, as is arbe is also a word for locusts, Yaharog Babara Yavna, and he killed the vines with hail. Vashikmosam Vanacha. The Shikmosam is a kind of tree. It says here a sycamore tree. I don't actually know what a sycamore tree is. I always thought Shikmosam were fig trees. So I'm not sure whether it's a fig tree or a sycamore tree, especially since I'm not sure what a sycamore tree is. With locusts. Vaisagir Labaram Beiram. He gave over their animals to the hail, Muknaam Larshafim, and their cattle to the fiery bolts. This was just a little while ago. Yishalach Bam, he dispatched against them, right? Charof Apo, Evra Vazam Vitzara, his anger, his wrath, his fury, Mishalach Malachai Ram, a delegation of evil messengers. Yifales Nasiv Lapo, he made a path for his anger. Lo Choshach Mimavas Nasham, the Chayasam Ledever Hiskir. He did not withhold their soul from death, and he delivered their body to pestilence. Leveling their anger, leveling a path for his anger, means that he kept his anger within a bound that the human person could understand. Meaning he could have let loose with his full force of anger, and they would have deserved it. But they wouldn't have understood what was happening. So instead, he kept it within the realm of what a person could understand. Okay, fine. It's going to be dark. You don't let him go. It's going to be dark. I'm in charge of the sun, and I say no more sun. Right? So he could have just had the sun blow up. Right? But he kept it on a path within the fact that the sun blowing up won't make an impression on people. Everybody will just freeze to death. Right? He kept it within the path that people would understand. Right? Yet, demonstrating completely that he was in charge. You know, by the plague of the firstborn, we forget sometimes, if you were an Egyptian and you were living in Pittsburgh, your firstborn son died also. Any Egyptian anywhere in the world, their firstborn died. And if you were vacationing in Egypt, bad choice, if you weren't Jewish, because your firstborn was going to die also. Ve'chakol b'chor Mitzrayim, he smote every firstborn in Egypt. Reishis einim ba'aleicham, the first fruit of their strength and the tats of Cha. Right? However, when it came to the Jewish people, ve'yasa kitzonamo, he caused his people to journey like sheep, and he led them as a flock in the desert. A shepherd tends to his sheep with tenderness. Hashem, on the one hand, is letting loose this amazing anger, on the one hand, and on the other hand, he's taking his people out, and he's providing for our every need, like a shepherd would. On page 6, in verse 53, he says, Ve'nachem lavetach, ve'yanchem lavetach v'lo pachadu. He led them securely, and they were not afraid. Ve'es oivehem kisa hayam, and the sea covered their enemies. Now, the truth is, they were occasionally afraid. But when they were afraid, Hashem right away gave them something to comfort them. So after they came through, after the Yam Suf, they turned around, and they saw, hey, it's nice and dry, the Egyptians are coming too. So they got scared. They complained to Hashem, look, the Egyptians are coming too. They said, don't worry, I got it. No problem. They drowned the Egyptians. So when they did get scared, he took care of them. We're going to see that one of the things that David HaMelech did as a shepherd is when you lock the sheep in at night, usually when you're a shepherd, what happens is you shepherd all the sheep and when it's time to put them into, when it's time for them to go nighty-night for the night, you can't believe I said that, let alone on the tape. He puts them into the pen, and he locks up the pen. And then the shepherd goes home. His work is done for the day. The next morning he comes back, he unlocks the pan, feeds them, takes them out, whatever shepherding you have to do. David HaMelech, after the pens were locked, was concerned that the sheep might still need something, so he would go in and lay down with the sheep and lay down in the pens to make sure that the sheep didn't want for anything. Right? That's the kind of shepherd that Hashem wanted for his people. Now he says, Vayivayim el gavul kodshoi, brought them to the border of his sanctuary. Harzeh konso yaminu, this mountain that his right hand had acquired. This is referring to bringing, of course, to Eretz Yisrael, and finally to the place of the where the base of Mikdash would be built, the Temple Mount. And this gets us to what to the period in history that Asaph is going to make a big deal of now. And that's the period of the Shoftim, the judges. I have to say that, at least for me personally, the era of the Shoftim is really not an era that is A, very well understood, or B, studied very much. The era of the Shoftim would be from after Yoshua ben Nun led them into Eretz Yisrael until the time of Shmuel HaNavi and the coronation of Shaul as the first Melech. That period is called the period of the judges, the Shoftim. Now, what happened is Yoshua designated the boundaries that each Shevet was supposed to have in Eretz Yisrael. And they drew the borders and the lines where everybody was supposed to be. However, after Yoshua's death, most of the tribes had not yet conquered all of the territory that had been assigned to them. So they selected the tribe of Yehuda to lead them in their effort to continue to conquer the rest of Canaan. Now, the tribe of Shimon joined up with Yehuda because their territories were next to each other, and they captured their area. And other tribes made sort of little alliances. Us two will go help capture our little area over here. And the Shvatim started making little mini partnerships with themselves. Big warning bell should be going off right here. And they are, because that's not exactly what we were supposed to be doing. And what happened is, the Jews got tired of all this war. And they said, you know what? We got to start growing our crops, planting our fields, enough of this war. Now, interestingly enough, why were they short of men? That's one big reason they were short of men. Who stayed on the other side of the Yarden, the Jordan River? Right, they helped initially, and then they were allowed to go back and settle on the other side of the Yarden, leaving us with less manpower. So while we're not going to go into that tonight, it's a very interesting idea as to why Moshe Rabbeinu let them do that. Because we did not have really the manpower to really swarm and completely take over the country. And war becomes very tiresome. I'm not meaning to be trite, but it does. And they said, listen, we got to start settling down. So you know what? So there's still some Canaanim living around here. What's the big deal? More alarm bells should be going off now. The Torah says, you have to destroy all their altars, but you can't leave the Canaanim there as practicing their Avodah Zorah in your midst. Yeah, okay. Now, as long as really the people from Yoshua's generation, that like sort of generation Sanhedrin and Gedalim were around, it actually worked out okay because they didn't mix with the Canaanim and they didn't do any Avodah Zorah. They just stayed and they built their own communities and they planted this, you know, everything was agricultural based. There's a lot of farming to be done. It's a lot of work, you know, and if we're going to feed ourselves, we have to start all this farming. And so that worked out okay. But what happened is as subsequent generations came along, the influence of the surrounding Canaanim and worshippers of Avodah Zorah who had never been chased out of the land began to grow more and more. Sometimes it would work out okay, and sometimes the Canaanim or other pagan tribes would oppress the Jews or have a war with them or convince them to come and do some Avodah Zorah. It was a time that the Pasuk describes to us as telling us that every man did what was right in his own eyes. There was no real central leadership telling us what to do or guiding us both either religiously or politically. The Sanhedrin was not really did not really have koach over all the tribes. People didn't listen. And there were no individual leaders like a Yoshua. Hashem told Yoshua what to do. Everybody's going to follow Yoshua. And after that, so sometimes there would arise a leader. And those leaders were called shoftim. They were called judges. There's no real official criteria for becoming a judge. You don't get appointed by Hashem. The Navi doesn't have to appoint you. It's sort of a position that is opened up for grabs. And sometimes a shofet would arise, and he or she would do tremendous things, and the Jewish people would start back on the path, and they would get rid of all this Avodah Zarah, and they would reopen the yeshivas, and everything was going well, and then, you know, another judge would come along, or maybe it was sort of back to where we were. And these two shevatim over here never really liked that judge anyway, right? And so there were great heights, for example, under Devorah, on Neviah, right, who was a shofetis? Is that the correct? Was a shofetis. She was one of the high points of the period of the shoftim. She had Klal Yisrael on a tremendous level. In the book of Ruth, when we read about Boaz, Boaz was a shofet. There were shoftim, and we have a book of shoftim. There were shoftim that arose to great heights, but it was a very lumpy thing, up and down. Any given generation over those 400 years, maybe up, maybe down. 400 years was the period of the shoftim. So with the right shofet and people willing to listen to that shofet or shofetis, they could do good. They could be all right. With nobody available with that kind of leadership, or with the tribes too busy arguing with each other, which was often a problem. And throughout this period, the tribe of Ephraim was constantly still insisting they be in charge, because they were descended from Yosef at Tzadik, and they had the right to be. And the other tribes were having none of it. So there was a lot of arguing within each other. Arguing against each other. So it was very hard to come together under a particular shofet. It took someone like a Devorah to do that. It took a very, very amazing and intense person to pull together the Jews at all during this period. Everybody had their own idea about what should be done. So now let's see what Asaph says in starting in 57. 57 in Nud Zion. This is Vayasigu. I'm sorry. 57. Vayisogu, Vayivgidu, Gavoysa. They turned back and they were treacherous to their forefathers. Nachpachu Keshis Remia. They were like a deceitful bow and arrow. So a deceitful bow and arrow is something that doesn't always go where you want it to. Sometimes it does. But sometimes it got that little tricky swing to it, and sometimes you shoot it and it goes the wrong direction. That's how we work. Vechisu v'mabosam. They provoked him with their bamos. Right? V'sizleim yakinu. And with their graven images, they angered him. This translation, they provoked him here with their high places. Bamos, I guess, literally does mean high places, but that's not what it's talking about here. Bamos were altars, mizbeach, that people made to bring personal sacrifices on their own property. You're not allowed to do that. You cannot bring korbanos outside of the Mishkan and outside of the Beis HaMikdash. Nonetheless, this was a constant battle. People wanted to have their own bamos and their own korbanos. We're going to have our guys over here, going to make a really cool bama, and we're going to bring korbanos to Hashem on it. And of course, in less good days, those same bamos could be used to bring korbanos to Avodah Zarah. Those bamos were a constant problem, and even Devorah, and even some of the great leaders at the time, were never able to completely get rid of these bamos. And he angered them with their idols. So sometimes, this is almost incredible, but they got jealous of the success and prosperity of the surrounding nations. They were so busy arguing over themselves, with themselves, that the only time they could come together was to agree that the other guys got it better than us. So rather than come together and try and recreate what we had under a Devorah or something like that, they said, well, you know what? Maybe we should like do what they do. Maybe we should like have a few korbanos to some idols. This did not please Hashem. Shama Elokim v'sabar. God heard and he became very upset. Vayimas v'od Yisrael. And he kicked out Yisrael. What does that mean? It's referring to one of the most disgraceful and humiliating episodes in Jewish history when the Plishtim came to Eretz Yisrael and they took the Aron with the Ark, with the Luchos, with the tablets inside of it, and they took it back with them. You know what them said? If you don't want the Aron and you don't want the Luchos, let them have it. This was towards the end of the period of the Shoftim, and in fact, one of the things that David will accomplish is the bringing back of the Aron from the Plishtim. And Shaul will die in battle against the Plishtim, and the Plishtim will be the last enemy of Klal Yisrael that Shaul and David vanquish. They are the toughest and most determined enemies, and they were able to take back the Aron. So we had a Mishkan, a beautiful Mishkan. And when you pulled back the curtain, there was no more Aron there. It was a humiliating experience for the entire nation. And it says, Vayitosh Mishkan Shilo, and he abandoned the Mishkan in Shilo. Ohel Shikin V'adam, that he had stationed among men. So the Mishkan was in Shilo for 369 years. And we know, of course, the Mishkan was the forerunner of the Beis HaMikdash. At the time, yet Hashem had not decided that we were worthy of having a king and building the Beis HaMikdash. But for 369 years, the Mishkan was in Shiloh. It will never be in Shiloh again. When the Aron comes back, they will bypass Shiloh, and Shiloh is history. Some said, if you don't want it, the same thing he told the people that when he finally, after the 10th time they tested him, if you don't want what I have to offer, then you don't need it. If you don't want, then the Plishtim can take it. Why should I protect it? By Yiten Lajvi Uzo, he delivered his might into captivity, Vasif Arto V'yad Tsar, and his glory into the hand of the adversary. Now, his might and his glory, with the Aron and the Luchos, fortified Klal Yisrael in battle. Whether it was mystically, or whether it was the power of Hashem, or whether it was just an encouragement, whatever it was, without the Aron and the Luchos, they had no heart and no ability for battle. And in fact, in the next pasuk, it'll say, "Vayasker l'cherev amo." He delivered his own people to the sword. Uvenachlaso hisaber, and he became incensed with his inheritance. 30,000 Jewish soldiers were killed in that battle. 30,000 Jewish soldiers were killed in that battle with the Plishtim. And we lost. And they took the Aron. Bachurav achla esh, fire consumed the youths, v'solosav lo hula, and the young ladies were not married. You know, we have a rule in the Torah, that when you go out to war, if a person just got married, he's exempt from fighting in the army. However, in a defensive war, where everything is at risk, then all people are called up, even young men who are newly married. So that's what this pasuk is referring to, that fire consumed his youths, and even the young maidens. Oftentimes they would get engaged and their husband would be killed in the war before they could even get married. Choana b'cherev nafla. His priest fell by the sword, while Manasav lo sikbena, but the widows did not weep. It's referring to an incident where the Gohanim were killed, and the widows of the Gohanim themselves were so distraught that they died, never having had a chance to weep for their husbands who were killed in battle by the Plishtim. On page 7, Pasuk 65 says, Vikat keyashein Hashem. And the Lord awoke as one asleep, ki gibor mizronein miyayin, like a mighty man shouting with wine. 400 years he's been patient. V'yach tzar avachor, and he smote his adversaries, cherpam olam nasan lamo, and he gave them from the rear, and he gave them perpetual disgrace. Now, the Meforshim have a machlokes, as he smote his adversaries from the rear. Who's that talking about? However, the most interesting pshat, which most of the Meforshim seem to agree, is struck them from the rear, is referring to the Plishtim. And actually, one of the ways that the Plishtim were defeated is the entire army came down with hemorrhoids. And that's what it's referring to when he says he disgraced them from the, he got them from the rear. And just in terms of it gave them perpetual disgrace, even though we got the Aron back, it was a disgrace for all the world to see how Hashem deserted us. Remember, the whole world knew that Hashem took us out of Egypt. Nobody was going to start up with the Jewish people. Today we have a situation where there are people that Rahman al-Islam don't even believe in the events that were written in the Chumash. In the times of yore, in the times of the Chumash itself and thereafter, there was nobody that didn't believe it. Every nation in the world knew that you start up with the Jews and their God is going to crush you. However, they also knew that if they are not on good terms with their God right now, then anything's fair game. So the whole world watched as we were disgraced and our holy vessels were taken by the Plishtim, 30,000 people killed, and Hashem didn't do a thing to stop it. It was a disgrace. The entire world was laughing at us. We were the laughing stock of the world. It's a perpetual disgrace. It's a disgrace olam, forever. Never, there's no way to ever recover from that disgrace. Vayimas ba'ol Yosef. He rejected the tent of Yosef. Uveshevet Ephraim lo vachar. Says, you know what? No person from the tribe of Ephraim will ever be a king, will ever be a monarch, will never have any royal position. And furthermore, when the Aron came back, they didn't take it back to Shiloh. Whose shevet was Shiloh in? Shiloh was in the property of the Ephraim. They bypassed Shiloh, and Hashem said that the base of Mikdash and the Mishkan will never be in any land owned by a person of the Ephraim tribe, of Shevet Ephraim, and no person from B'nai Ephraim will ever rule in Klal Yisrael. Vayivchar, as Shevet Yehuda, he chose tribe of Yehuda, as Har Tzion, Asher Ahev, that he loved. Vayiven Kemorami, Mikdasho, and he built his Mikdash, his sanctuary, like the high heavens, Ke'eret Yisadil Oilam, like the earth, he established it forever. Now, it's established forever. The base of Mikdash can never be built in a different place. In fact, when we built the second base of Mikdash, the Navi had to come and show us where to build, exactly where the Kodesh HaKodeshim is supposed to be, because once it was put in its proper place, the Torah calls it Makom Asher Yivchar, the place that I will choose. Once it's chosen, where the base of Mikdash will be, it can never be unchosen. Therefore, it can only be in that same place. So he established it forever. The base of Mikdash will always be in that place. The Navi had to come and show us where to build the base of Mikdash. And in fact, Azus Hashem, the Mehera, when we build the third base of Mikdash, once again, a Navi will show us where to build exactly and where the Kodesh HaKodeshim is supposed to be. So what did Hashem do to right this situation? The situation is intolerable. Hashem's view. It's true we had our ups, but we've had our downs. Ephraim wants power. We can't agree with each other. We're jealous of our neighbors. We have vamos. Sometimes we come together in great moments, and other times we're sacrificing to Avodah Zarah and our vamos. The situation is intolerable. It can't go on like this. So Hashem's answer is in verse 70. What I will do to solve the situation, says Hashem, and Asaf is explaining to us, Vayivchar, I will choose B'David Avdo, I will choose David, my servant. V'yikachehu, V'mimloson, and took him from the sheepcotes. From the sheepcotes is the pens where the sheep stay. David's devotion to Hashem was so high that Hashem felt he was the answer to the problems. Me'achar alos heviyu. From behind the ewes he bought him. Liros b'Yaakov amai, to shepherd Yaakov his people, uvi Yisrael nachlaso, and Israel his heritage. Yaakov refers to the grant of political leadership to David, meaning that David would be the head of the country, kingdom, the army, etc. And Yisrael refers to the fact that he would also be in charge of all spiritual matters for the people. Tis vayiram Tzom Levavo. We shepherd them according to the integrity of his heart, with Sinus Kapav Yanchem, and with the skill of his hands he led them. Now why did Bnei Ephraim want to be leaders? They wanted to be leaders because it's a pretty cool job. You get a lot of glory, you get a lot of perks, you get a lot of money, you get a lot of kavod. They wanted to be leaders for all the wrong reasons. Why did David HaMelech want to lead the Jewish people? It's a trick question. Good. The answer is he didn't. He only wanted to do what Hashem wanted him to do. He would have been perfectly happy spending the rest of his life meditating all night on the beauties of Hashem's world.
Is there a parallel that Moshe was a shepherd, David is a shepherd?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those qualities that Moshe Rabbeinu and David HaMelech displayed as shepherds, or honed as shepherds, if you will, made them into fit leaders for Klal Yisrael. Because we, sheep are hard to herd in the same direction. I won't make the obvious comparison that so are we. But yes, those qualities that they honed as shepherds made them fit to be leaders of the Jewish people. The tremendous talent of David was, besides always wanting to do what Hashem wanted, was he was able to take spiritual ideas and translate them into concrete action for people to do. Now, you can have a leader that's a very spiritual person and is full of great ruchnias. And what happens? Nothing happens. It doesn't go anywhere. Because they don't know how to tell people what to do and how to get that enacted and how to translate that into action. Sometimes you see organizations or, you know, in past days that were headed by amazing tzaddikim. How could such a thing fail? And how could the reason is because there's an extra little nakuda that David HaMelech was able to do, and that is he was able to take, oh, we should all be spiritual people, and say, okay, and here's what we're going to do that. Everybody line up to the left. That was an amazing accomplishment. And that, his ability to shepherd the people and his strong desire to simply do what Hashem wanted, made him the answer to the problem. Now, we had a king already, Shaul HaMelech. We talked before that Shaul HaMelech was a tremendous tzaddik. Chazal tell us many, many, many stories of the tremendous tzidkus of Shaul HaMelech. There were times when he felt bad about having to raise taxes, so he paid the army out of his own pocket. In Shaul HaMelech's reign, they used to have, you know, the level of Hachnasas Orchim, the level of, was just incredible. And yet Shaul HaMelech, with all that, lost the right to be king. Because being a tzaddik was not enough. You had to be able to take it and do something concrete with that tzidkus. And David HaMelech was able to do that. Now, David was a tzaddik in every way. And he, you know, the areas that he excelled in, you know, are numerous. He was the consummate warrior. He was the best general. He was the best poet, he was the best musician, he was the best Talmud Chacham, he was the best Posek, he was the best at everything. He was all of these things rolled into one. Yet his whole reign, he had terrible opposition. We look back at David HaMelech. How could anybody oppose David HaMelech? If David HaMelech walked into the room right now and said, "Can I be king?" Who would say anything? And it didn't work quite that way during his lifetime. They harassed him to no end. First of all, you're not a legitimate king. You're descended from Rus, you might not even be Jewish. Right? His sons rebelled against him. He had such sorus, person shouldn't know from. Yet, every kapitza we read, David HaMelech is thanking Hashem for everything he gets in his life. Things that to us would seem horrible. And his only reaction is, "Thank you, Hashem." And when he does succeed at something, does he say, "I succeeded"? Gives the credit to Hashem. So why does he do that? And the answer is a simple four words. Because Hashem said so. David's emuna and betachin almost seems, if you don't look closely enough, Chas v'Shalom, to be simplistic. He doesn't question, he doesn't ask. What Hashem says, he does. That's it. Hashem said David should be Melech. David never understood his whole life why people are hocking him about being Melech. He didn't ask to be Melech. Hashem said so. And if Hashem says something, we do it. If Hashem wants you to be Melech, then we'll make you Melech. Then I'll bow down to you. Great. He never understood. Kamba times we've seen, he says, why are people acting like this? He says, why are people doing this? He's not just crying in frustration. He does not understand because Hashem said do this, and that's what you do. That's not simplistic. That's a madriga that very few people will ever reach. Asaph has a point here. Asaph's point is that Hashem said David should be Melech. Yet people are arguing. Well, you know what? Those who don't study history, said Asaph, are doomed to repeat it. Let me teach you a little history. Hashem said, don't go out of Mitzrayim until I tell you. And some of the Bnei Ephraim did. And it was disastrous. Hashem said, I'll take care of you in the Midbar. And some people didn't believe it. And the results were disastrous. If you eat the man, both your body and your neshama will be satisfied. Yum, eat it. Well, we don't know if we want to or not. Every time Hashem says to do something, Hashem says, go into the land, get out all the worshippers of Avodah Zorah, settle the land, here's what you got to do. Written. He even wrote it down for us in the Chumash, so we wouldn't forget. We get there, halfway through the job, it's a pretty hard job, and you know what, I think we'll take a little break now, and we'll start farming, and we'll get back to this conquering thing. Asaph is saying, if you don't study history, you miss the key lesson, which is, Amunah and Betachon require you to just do what Hashem says already. Stop fighting. You know, we have an expression in my company, don't fight the work. Sometimes you have a job to do. And first you go get a cup of coffee, and you know, then, well, you know what, I didn't check my email in the last 5 minutes, and there could be some important emails, and I just thought of a great idea for a new product, I'm going to write up a little memo, and all you were supposed to do was this 10-minute job. And at the end of the day, the 10-minute job isn't done. Why? Because you resist just being told what to do. In my company, a lot of times, someone will come over and say, do this. You know, Hashem, obviously, but Hashem is saying, just do this. Just do it. Well, we didn't always trust in history, Asaph says, and look what happened. So now that Hashem has said the answer to the problem is David HaMelech, all of you people who are hocking against David HaMelech, stop it. Learn your lesson from history and do what Hashem tells you. Asaph is not pulling any punches here. He's a promoter of David. He's writing this because he feels that David is not being treated fairly. And David included in Tehillim. It's interesting that David himself never wrote anything to indicate that he felt there was a slight, any drop of unfairness. Yet Asaph writes that, and David includes it in Tehillim. I'm not sure exactly what message we get from there, but David would never say such a thing about himself. But Asaph can come along and he can say, stop it. Just stop it. It's like sometimes you have a kid and they're just running and doing everything you told them not to do, and finally you say, just stop it. He says, what am I supposed to stop? Just stop it. Just do what I tell you. After 400 years, Hashem said, here's David, just do what I tell you. Right? I'm fed up. Do you have no memory of history? Do you not remember everything I did for you? Here's David. He's going to solve the problem. You better listen.
And Shaul didn't listen.
Correct. Shaul did not listen. That did not, and if, I don't have a shmuel right here in front of me, but if you look over there at the wording, when the Navi comes to chastise Shmuel, to chastise Shaul, the wording is so strong and severe, you don't see wording much like that in Nach. Tells them how Hashem is angry with him, he's ripping out his malchus. Alright, Hashem, the lesson over there is, it's beating him over the head. The language is so strong about how angry Hashem was over this. Right? And Shaul asks for another chance. And the Navi says, absolutely not. And he further berates him in the name of Hashem. Berates him just terribly. There's a Melech Yisrael. And even if it weren't, this line, he really, you won't see such strong language in almost all the rest of Nach. The strong language that the Navi uses in the name of Hashem against Shaul, because they didn't listen. You know what? Because Hashem has had enough of not listening. Okay. He does all this, and every time it looks like we're going to get there, poof, well, somebody messes up. Now, far be it from me to say that such a thing still exists today. However, I will point out that we still today have the conflict between the B'nai Ephraim and the David HaMelech. There are people who wish to rule for all the wrong reasons. And there are people who wish to rule for the right reasons. The people who wish to rule for the right reasons, Hashem says, just listen to them. But this idea of just doing what Hashem says, just follow the people I give you. I gave you Yeshua, now I'm giving you David HaMelech to solve the problem. That's what Asaph is leading. This whole 72 Pesukim are leading up to that point. Hashem said David HaMelech is here. Just do what Hashem said and follow David HaMelech. Would that it worked quite that simply, and would that Asaph's words had been more listened to. Because David's opposition never died down during his entire lifetime. It was only in his son Shlomo that, and in fact, when the kingdoms of Yehuda and Yisrael split, we don't really have time to go into this right now, but of course the leader of that split was someone from the tribe of Ephraim. Couldn't get over this fact. Just do what Hashem says and follow the leader, David HaMelech. Right? David is the answer. That's what Asaph is trying to say in the 72 Pesukim that he's been leading up for all these weeks. Questions?
Yes.